The date is the 28th of September, 1978, and this is an interview with Lieutenant General Lane by Dr. Ari Troy and Mr. Chris Main, somewhere in the background. Yes.
Okay.
Well, after I came back from the Imperial Defense College in January of 1956, I was put into the planning organization in Air Force headquarters, and I became the director of Air Plans and Programs, DAPP. And I was directly responsible to the chief of plans and intelligence, who at that time was Murray Lister.
Who was the head? Who was above him? Who was the,
Well, above him at that time, the vice chief was ADM Smith, Doug Smith.
Right.
And then he was the vice chief, and then, of course, at that, there was a change. Slemon was still the chief.
I see.
But Slemon left soon after that to go down to NORAD.
Right.
Because NORAD came into existence.
Right.
And he went down as the first Canadian deputy commander of NORAD.
Yes.
And Hugh Campbell took over as the chief. Now, Hugh Campbell had been the air member for personnel before he took over as chief, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
He was either in the Air Division or he had come back and was AMP, rather, one of those two spots. But anyway,
yeah,
he became the chief because it becomes important because a lot of my dealings were more with Campbell as during this next period of my tour at Air Force headquarters than with Slemon, because Slemon was, it wasn't very long after that Slemon left.
So this would be 1956.
Yeah,
this would be the...
Yeah.
About 1 year before the Conservatives come into power.
That's right. That's right.
And when you come back, of course, presumably the first thing you would do would be to see what has been going through the meat grinder.
Well, we were still, of course, in the period of expansion.
Yeah.
There were a lot of big programs underway. Now, the biggest one at this time was the Arrow.
Yeah.
The Arrow was cranking up like crazy, and the expenditures were growing every bloody day, the cost of that program. And I might just say a few words about the Arrow. I can't remember whether we've gone into this or not, but the Arrow was almost a complete... Well, it was. It was a complete system of about four major components, and every component was new. There was nothing to fall back on. Everything was brand new. Everything was state-of-the-art. The airframe was state-of-the-art. The engine was state-of-the-art. The electronic system was state-of-the-art. And the missile, the velvet glove, as it was called, was being developed by the Defense Research Board. And it was a state-of-the-art missile. They had had no background, no experience to go fall back on, as some of the bigger companies had. It was all literally state-of-the-art. So you had...
And this was Canadian state-of-the-art.
All Canadian state-of-the-art. Mind you, Avro had an awful input from a lot of the British who were a part of the company. But it was a Canadian development and a Canadian state-of-the-art.
Yeah.
Certainly in DRB it was, with the missile, the velvet glove. So you had a very, very unique situation where you were trying to bring together four major components into one total system, all state-of-the-art, and expect it to work, which was an enormous gamble. But aside from the gamble, I might just say that you take the best example I can think of this is the French aircraft designer. They make the F-1, famous, still in existence, still going strong, making very good aircraft at the moment. He never, in all of his aircraft designs, never brought in more than one-third of a new airplane as state-of-the-art. He would never do it. In other words, he would work on two-thirds of proven design, engineering, material, metal, whatever it might be, and then would tack on one-third of state-of-the-art. And as a result, of course, he's never been wrong. He's always been extremely good. Now, Dassault. And he didn't give a damn what kind of pressure he was under. He would never give away on that principle that he would never, no more than one-third of a new aircraft design would be state-of-the-art. Yet here we were with 100% state-of-the-art. Well, the impact of that state-of-the-art was, of course, cost, because there was no way of knowing what the costs were going to be. It was a development program right across the board. And therefore, the engineers and the scientists, the people working on these various components, constantly didn't know quite what they were going to run into. And as a result, it was an ongoing program of almost quarterly saying, we need more money for this particular problem, or we've run into a major problem, there will be not going to be a delay, or we spend a lot of money, and we'll get over it that much more quickly. So on it went. Well, as a result, all of these costs began to escalate. But the incredible thing was that each component was proving out. They all had snags. I can remember one, the dish, the radar dish for the airplane. When they getting into the frequency they wanted to use, they suddenly found that the dish, I think it was going to be 1 inch too wide for the airframe. This kind of silly thing happened, but that's a catastrophe when you're working on a design of a whole new radar system, plus, of course, the design of the fuselage. And that caused a lot of hiccups, and it took money to straighten it out. there were other ones with the engine. State-of-the-art engine. And it had problems on the test bed. And so there was redesign that had to be done, re-engineering. And, of course, every one of those ran into millions of dollars.
Was this all being done by the one company?
This was all being done, except for the Velvet Glove. Velvet Glove was being developed by Defense Research Board in their laboratories. I'm talking now about the breadboard model, not a production model, breadboard. And they developed several breadboard models, which were ultimately fired. And I think, if I remember correctly, they were fired at Cold Lake, on the range at Cold Lake. And, by God, it worked like a bomb. It was a terrific weapon. Similarly, of course, notwithstanding all the hiccups with the various components, when they were finally all brought together into the airplane, and it did its first taxi trials, and then which went extremely well, and then its first flight, the whole damn thing came together and it worked. to everyone's complete and utter astonishment, it worked. The heavy critics of the program were those who just were working on the theory that it was impossible to bring together four major components into all state-of-the-art and have it work. Something was going to come apart. And it would only take one component to come apart, and the whole system would have to be completely re-engineered, redesigned.
Well, now, at what stage was this, Reg?
I came back, we must have been getting on the development stage was well down the road, because they were beginning to put together the prototypes.
Yeah.
And I think we must have been getting awfully close. I can't remember the date for the first flight, but it must have been sometime in 57. Somewhere in there, 57, in that early 58 period, somewhere there, because they were doing taxi trials. In other words, the first bird had been put together. And that's a long time in the development program of an airplane after you've put it all together, after you've actually got it in so that it'll taxi and begin to do your taxi trials. Before you even put it into the air, you're going through months and months and months of development and testing, and it's enormous, because not only is there the work going on the prototype, the first prototype, which is now assembled, but there's continuing work going on the components in the shops, improving. There's still faults, still taking out these faults, improving them.
What about your colleagues? How do they feel towards it?
Oh, everybody was enthused as hell about the whole thing. It really was. When was the first rollout?
Well, now that was the
October 57.
October
unveiling.
57.
Okay. Yeah. Now that was the unveiling, and it was unveiled because it was going to start doing its taxi trials. You see, they wouldn't have unveiled that until that was when the first machine was put together, and it was being brought out, and from there on it would start its flight trials.
Oh, I thought it had flown before then.
No. This is when it's first put together and it's being rolled out. And now they're going to start doing all their taxi trials. It was the first time anybody had had a real good look at that aircraft, was when it was unveiled. They had to do it that way, because as soon as it came out of the hangars at Everill in Toronto, there was no question of any of even security or what was happening with that bird. None. It was now out in public view. And the other thing was, of course, great pressure, both from the department and from within the company, to get this bird into the air, to prove it. because these costs were escalating and escalating and escalating and going up and up and up. And it reached the point, well, I guess I better clear up this particular program. Then the Conservatives came in, they were elected to power, and it was the first time that the department had been through a change of government in umpteen dozen years. Well, no one had worked under any other government but the Liberals.
First time since 1935.
So we didn't know, then, and there was nobody, there was, had been no Air Force headquarters in those days of any significance, so there was great, what, we even went to Washington, would you believe, to say, what happens when you get a change of government? Because they were having changes down there all the damn time. And they all said, nothing. It's just the same thing. There may be a few policies changed, but programs are all launched, and the whole thing just keeps going. So we came back and said, well, I guess that's the only way we can go. We got to keep these things rolling.
Who's the we that you're talking about?
Talking about plans. Plans and operations in Air Force headquarters.
Did you happen to be down there, or did you go down there
specially? No. We happened to be down there. Yeah. And we brought this whole thing up because we were concerned. We didn't know what to expect with a new government. Because none of us had ever experienced
a change of government.
So we didn't know what to expect. And what we had to do and with this change of government, of course, was to prepare an incredible number of briefings. The minister, who would have been the minister, the first minister? Was it Perks, the first minister? We must have spent, well, we did. We spent weeks briefing him. Now, we must remember that all the other services, too, are involved in this.
Yeah.
Briefing him on where we stand, the programs that are in the mill, where they stand, the costs. And I repeat, we were in an increasing budget period when there was a fair amount of money being spent on a lot of ongoing programs. Mm-hmm. And therefore, where they stood, we had to resubstantiate all of these programs. It was going like zero-based budgeting. You had to go right back to square one and support everything from the very beginning. So a lot of effort went into briefing the minister, and then, of course, the Cabinet Defense Committee were being briefed as well by the chiefs as to what the major programs were and where they stood. So there was it took a lot of effort. And, again, the Conservatives had several major problems. I'm dealing with the Arrow, but there are others which I'll come to shortly. Well, the Arrow expenditures started to climb, and I began to get very, very worried. Now, I have to come back to my job as Director of Air Plans and Programs, because it was my job to put together the program for the Air Force on an annual basis, which was then used to prepare the annual estimates for the coming fiscal year. And we used to start the estimates about, I used to try and have my program ready about March or April of the year preceding the fiscal year that the estimates were going to be prepared for. Mm-hmm. Then I would get my program out, and then during the summertime, all the various departments, or directorates and divisions of the headquarters would be working on my program, putting together their estimates. And then by about September, October, we'd have the first real feel of the total money required by the Air Force for the next fiscal year. Mm-hmm. And then we would sit down and begin to screen out what was not necessary or what was... we'd just call it screening. It was really a substantiation by the program manager of his requirements of money for the coming fiscal year, and he had to stand up and be counted. It was just that. But there was a procedure for screening estimates. And then I guess it would be October or early November when we would get a figure from Treasury Board of what we were going to be permitted to have. Not what we wanted, but what we were going to be permitted to have for the coming fiscal year. And invariably, that was way, way, way below what the estimates were. So then that was when the serious screening started. And when it was a real hard-nosed, hard-headed, sharpened pencils, with every program manager going down and lopping out money here, lopping out money there, trying to get the budget, the estimates, down to the figure given to us by Treasury Board. And there were occasions when we really couldn't get it down. And it was then the chief who had to go to the minister, and the minister had to go back to the Treasury Board and say, we need more money. And occasionally, he would be successful. And we might get, say, another $100 million or something like that to help meet the program. But that was very much the exception. Normally, you had to stay within the figure that was given. Well, here we were now at this time getting into also a period when the expenditures, the government was beginning to get a little worried about the size of expenditures as well. Aside from the growing program, we would have gone on indefinitely, I suppose, with all these major programs. They were getting worried. Well, I guess it would be about 57 or 58, I began to get very worried about the money that was going into the ARRO program.
Like the Navy.
Well, I was worried because I could see the impact it was having on the rest of our programs.
Yeah.
In other words, if the ARRO program was going to go, then something else would have to give if we were going to stay within the kind of money that the Treasury Board said we could have. And I forget when it was, but I can remember one meeting with the boy up in the controller shop who really handled the major program monies. He was a colonel, or a group captain. Well, we were both group captains. And I can remember the two of us and another lad from the materiel shop who was responsible for all aircraft procurement. It was his baby to handle the programs. And then we had the financial shop, if you will, the controller shop, and I was the planner. And I can remember we sat down one day and we looked at the forecast of expenditures on the ARRO. And we just didn't know what to do. We were completely dumbfounded because the graph started to go off the chart. And we could see that within 3 or 4 years, the thing was just going to be unbearably expensive. And what to do? Well, my God, we hassled around. How could we cut the program, which was the first one?
Yeah.
How could we keep the program alive and cut expenditures? What would we do? And the first thing you always do when you try to cut a program is you stretch the program out. In other words, instead of making it a 2-year program, you make it a 3-year program or a 4-year program. Try to expand it. And no matter which way we hacked that damn thing, we still wound up with the same answer. We weren't going to have the kind of money that we needed. Not within the kind of ballpark that Treasury Board was giving us. And still keep all our other programs going. And they were all major programs. You reached a point where you couldn't cancel any of the programs because they were all part of a system.
Can I interrupt at this point for a moment, Reg? I know this is a very complicated problem that you have, but I think this is a good point. As I remember it, one of the big factors that comes in at this time, and indeed perhaps even before your time, but certainly in this period, 57-58, is the cost per unit of the plane. In other words, the attempt by the government to sell the ARRO to other NATO countries.
Well, we were dealing, of course, in the total cost of the program, which ultimately gets translated back into a unit cost.
Yeah.
But a unit cost figure, and I've always stayed away from unit cost because it's a terribly misleading thing. When someone says the unit cost of that vehicle or that airplane is X dollars, then you have to stop and say, all right, what is included in that? Now, just like you going and buying a car, if you go and you just gone and bought a new car, and you paid X amount for it, and that money sounds to be like a damn good buy, then I would immediately say, but what extras did you get?
Yeah.
Did you get any?
Yeah.
Or was that a bare machine? What about spare parts?
Yeah.
Did you get any tools?
Yeah.
And, of course, as you get into more complex things, the spare parts.
Yeah.
And, of course, when you get into more complex equipment, then you start talking in terms of training aids, which were just beginning to show their head and to be such an important thing, and now an accepted fact, synthetic trainers. So when you talk about a cost of a thing, you have to sit down and describe quite carefully. When you're talking in millions of dollars, you have to be very careful that people understand what you're talking about. So when we did try to interest other countries in the ARRO, and when the minister did go to these places, he went, though, with a complete package, if you will, as to what the costs would be. What the components would be, what we call flyaway cost would be, which was just a bare machine. and then what the various spare parts packages would be, what the ground handling equipment package would be. All of these things, which of course change the cost of what you call the cost of an airplane enormously, because those are very, very expensive items, and they escalate up. Well, we were not all of those items that I've mentioned, spare parts, training aids, the test equipment, the ground handling equipment, all of those were components of the Arrow program.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we had the various line items, mm-hmm. but all bracketed as total Arrow program. They were all directly related to the Arrow program. And we even went down to training, because you had to have, once you've got your first birds and started to train, how much was it going to cost to train a pilot to an acceptable standard on the Arrow? How many hours would it take? What kind of cost? And then when you got into operations, you got into a squadron, what was the hourly operating cost of that machine? So we had enormous costing figures going all the way down the line. And when I talk about, perhaps I made it sound a little too simple, that we could see the cost escalating, it was these future costs that we could see that were just getting out of control in relation to anything that we'd ever done before. Hell, we were flying airplanes at that time, but the hourly operating cost would probably be, at the most, say $600 or $700 an hour. And here, I can't remember the figures on the Arrow, but they would be at least double what we had been doing before. So all of a sudden, your operation and maintenance costs are doubled. And here we were talking about a fairly large fleet of these airplanes. Well, where the hell was all this money going to come from? We were talking about an incredible increase in our budget. And with a tightening, in a tightening financial environment.
Mm-hmm.
So we were stunned. It was the first time, that particular meeting was the first time that I think the three of us really faced up to the fact that this program was running away with us. And we'd all individually felt it, but it was such an important program.
Mm-hmm.
There was so much emotion attached to it. It was such a big thing for the industry and for Canada that none of us ever really wanted to face up to the fact that the costs were going nuts. Well, we finally, we reached a solution. We said, well, you only have one choice. We've got to go and brief the chief. The chief's got to know about this. So it was my job to go and tell the vice and the chief that he just simply had to get together.
To meet by the chief?
Yeah.
Chief Baker?
No, Chief of the Air Staff. Chief of the Air Staff. Chief of the Air Staff.
No, it's just the Chief of the Air Staff.
No. This is all still in the Air Force.
Okay.
Still in house. And so we did. And oh my God, what a meeting that was. Because, of course, they were just astounded at our projected cost figures. And again, everyone sort of sat around the table, and we went through the same bloody drill again. What do we do? What do we do? Well, of course, no decision was made right at that first meeting, but we had to produce papers, variations on the theme for the chief, every bloody thing you could think of, in an attempt to salvage something from this program. Well, of course, the sad tale, as it's now known, came out that there was nothing we could do. Well,
can I interrupt again at this time? Now, granted this be a top-level secret meeting and all that sort of thing, at what point does the press begin to judge pretty accurately that the sides of the cake are beginning to fold?
Very soon after that, because, of course, it was then that we had to bring in some people from defense production. They had to have some... The miniature hasn't been brought into the picture yet.
Yeah.
This is still all in-house. The committee, if you will, who were responsible for that whole production program had to get together. The deputy minister was brought into the act. The deputy minister of defense production was brought into the act.
Yeah.
And, of course, then the company was brought in. Because, of course, the company had to be brought in now to say what... Everyone had beaten their brains out and could find no solution, no answer to this enormous problem. So I went to the company and then threw it to the company. What do you suggest? What do you recommend? Well, of course, by that time, there were an awful lot of people that knew about this program. So, and it was so important and so big that the press began to get wind that something was going off the rails. And it was, I have no idea where the press got the information, but All they would have to do is talk to a few of these people who are now in the know and the company, and they would very quickly have put together that the problem, the program was in trouble financially.
It
that much
wasn't a leak then.
No.
There was no. I can't vouch for the company, nor can I vouch for defense production. But certainly there was no leak in the Air Force net, because we were just now worried. And it's funny how your mind will flip-flop. We were now worried of the political implications of a cancellation of that program. In other words, we'd gotten through the traumatic effect of realizing the program was beyond our means. Unless the government was willing to spend an enormous amount of money, and I'll come back to that in a minute, because I'm still working sort of in-house, we'd gotten through the realization and the trauma of cancellation or a pending cancellation. Now we're worried about what the hell the political impact is going to be. And more important, what's the impact going to be on the Air Force in terms of confidence and integrity in terms of all the other programs that we had underway. So we were beginning to not only beat a hasty retreat, but we were trying to dig in and build up our defenses against an onslaught, which we knew was going to come from all directions if the government went along the way we could only see, the way we could see. Well, it was finally reached the point that there was really no answer but now to fully brief the minister. The chief may have told the minister on the QT what was going on. If I know Campbell, he undoubtedly did, because he realized that too many people were getting into the know, and it might have gotten up to one of the cabinet ministers, and then all hell would break loose. Why hadn't you brought me in the picture? But it would probably have been done on an unofficial basis, because he didn't have all the paperwork necessary to give the ministers something that he could take to cabinet with alternatives or options and a recommendation. It was just that we are in trouble, and we're looking at it, but be prepared for the worst sort of thing. It's probably what happened. Well, when it did go, of course, forward, it went forward with all the facts were laid out. Here is what it was. And the options were an incredible increase in funding for the Air Force or cancellation of the program. And there really were only the two options.
Excuse me, so we're talking about incredible funding, but what kind of dollars? I know, I'm not trying to pin you down
on
a dollar.
Well, I can't remember exact figures, but let me think. I think at that meeting that we had, it began to look at that, but with the coming year's estimates, it looked as if the cost of that machine, now I'm not going to talk about production cost plus the components that would be required to support it without including the O&M costs. I'm just talking about a package. The airplane plus some, 1 year's spare parts, the ground handling equipment, just that as a package. The cost, as I recall, reached $10 million a copy. Now, $10 million a copy in those days was an staggering amount of money.
Yeah.
But and maybe it was a $10 million that suddenly became that crossover line. We knew that you get above that, it's going into orbit. And that was for that year. And we knew that we could see the projection costs going up in the future years. And when you start to throw in O&M costs on top of that, once you start to get airplanes, then your O&M budget began to go like this, as well as your production costs. And now we're probably talking. Well, we never did project it forward in terms of a cost, because we realized that we were just wasting our time. And we had to go with that and say, is this what you're willing to kind of money at that moment? A little later, we went to the cabinet. And again, I can't remember total program figures, but the minister had the two options. One was to go to the cabinet and say, this program is going to cost about twice or three times or four times more than it had originally been estimated, which means that the Air Force is going to require a very large increase in their annual budget. And we knew damn well that the government was not willing to provide that kind of money. That kind of money just wasn't around.
They'd have to wipe out the
The other services would have taken an awful shellacking.
And they were howling at that time, too.
Yes, everybody was beginning to howl.
Yeah.
Sir, I'm wondering, it's not quite on topic, but I've talked to other fellows in other services, and their dealings with Treasury Board and your dealing are two different things. Now, I'm wondering if it's because of the error, because they said, or this one individual said specifically, that if they had their homework done, if they could justify their expenditure. There was no problem with
that's a fair statement. But we're here, there you're dealing with the, what I call the normal run-of-the-mill type of program. But not always. Treasury Board, on a specific program, yes, you could sell it. But you were still had to stay within the total amount of money for the year that Treasury Board had given you. And if you sold that program, and it was more than you had originally included in your estimate, you had to find the money from some other program to still stay within the brackets of the total money given to you by Treasury Board for the year. And which, of course, is passed by Parliament and becomes the actual budget. And there's no way, and even transferring money between votes, you have to go back to the House. So there's Treasury Board are locked in, too. Once the money is passed by the House, once the budget is approved in the House, you're locked in. And the only way you can get around that is by going back for supplementaries to the House at the end of the fiscal year, which, of course, governments hate like hell to do. And the department only did it a couple of times. But here we're talking in terms of small amounts of money in relation to the total budget. We're talking about money required to clean up some bills. Unforeseen in the original estimate. Treasury were always tough, extremely tough. But if you had a package, it would go forward. But it had to be within your program. That's right, your total program had to be.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Well, anyway, it wound up, of course, the decision was made to cancel. And then
who made the decision itself?
Oh, Diefenbaker and the cabinet. It went Diefenbaker, I assume. I don't know what went on in cabinet.
Yeah.
But it was a cabinet decision, and I assume that Dief was the one who finally made the decision on that because the political implications of it
were
incredible. Yeah.
Well, here again, in the House of Commons, there was a considerable amount of talk, complaints on the part of the opposition, the Liberals, and defense on the part of the Conservatives of their inability to interest other NATO countries in this machine. In other words, by 1958, we're talking about the need of only 100 of these aircraft at that time. Horrendous cost.
Yes.
Now, were you involved in any of that, or did you hear anything
of that? No, well, not directly, because this was handled by the minister's office. He was briefed that, I guess I said there were two options. There was a third option. The only way you can bring unit costs down, of course, is by a long run, a long production run. Now, it's a bit of a sop, because even a long run is not going to reduce your unit cost appreciably. It's going to bring it down. The big thing is it'll probably stop it from going up over the future years. If even that's a big step forward. But in terms of 50% reduction or something like that, to bring the cost of the program insofar as Canada or insofar as the Air Force was concerned down to something that was manageable, no way. It was a hope that something might be saved out of this. I never was all that keen on it. I knew about what was going on, but I kept saying, yes, I agree, it'd be great if we could sell this. Let's sell 500 of them. All that's going to do is mean a long production run. Your production is not going to be more, for the sake of argument, let's say it can't be more than 10 a month. Therefore, our unit cost to us is still going to be X amount of dollars, and those dollars are still a staggering amount of money. It doesn't affect the O&M costs, which you're going to be faced with. It doesn't affect all the other costs involved with the program. So, the add-on costs, if you will.
Yeah. The foreign sales wasn't going to make that tremendous difference.
No. It would...
One of the major arguments placed about the decision to cancel the Arrow was that there were no foreign sales.
We can get around. We can get around to... If... I'll jump to that, if you like, once the decision is made. Because and then if you have any other questions the prior getting up to that period,
Before you do that, let me throw another question at you, Reg. Perhaps it might be good to explain at this point. To your mind, what were the outstanding features of the Arrow?
Oh, the Arrow was, well, I When I say state of the art, I mean state of the art. It was development. It was research and development going into a machine all at the same time. And therefore, we were way ahead of anyone else at that time. Way ahead.
What would it do?
For example, let's take the airborne radar that was designed for this thing. Whereas up until that time, the Mark IV radar, those radars which were being used at that time, perhaps would have a pickup at, say, 12 miles, and then it would improve as you got closer. And it really was about 6 miles before you felt you were really good, and then 1 or 2 miles, no problem. This damn thing was going to pick something up at 50 miles. There was that kind of quantum leap forward. The engines were at a thrust rate, which was something that hadn't been developed to that particular time. In other words, the engine itself was a quantum leap forward. The airframe, the aerodynamics of the airframe, perhaps there was the least, the smallest leap forward. Although no one, the Mach 1 or Mach 2 airplane, this was a Mach 2 airplane, it was still a development thing. Airframe foils and so forth, airfoils, and the velvet glove, which was a self-seeking missile. Once it was launched, it would lock on and go. Well, again, it was something that people had thought about, but no one had actually built the hardware. So it was way ahead of anything else that was being not under development, but actually flying at that time. I would say they probably had about a 5-year head start on everybody else in all of those components.
What was the range of the velvet glove at that time?
I can't remember. Yeah. I can't remember. I don't remember. I never got too deeply involved myself with specific specifications, because I was in the program and planning phase. I attended many briefings, and obviously I would have been told, but it was not the sort of information that I was interested in as much as the operators. Yeah. If the operators were happy with it and accepted whatever it was, then I was happy, and I would take their judgment. All I was worried about was making the whole program as a plan come together.
And it was also designed, was it not, more specifically for Canadian use rather than European?
Yes, the specification for the airplane was prepared by the department, by the Air Force.
Yeah.
And it was, of course, a long-range airplane, and the requirement still exists today.
Yeah.
We still have it. And the hassle that's going on right now for the decision on an airplane to replace the 101s is still got the same basic requirement. Yeah. You want a long-range airplane, so it can get out into the north, get away from, and do an interception beyond the built-up areas, beyond the industrial areas. You've got to have an airplane that has an overriding safety factor for flying in those kind of areas where there are no airfields, no recovery way, which basically means a twin-engine airplane. Probably two people in the airplane, because one man, even today, there's great discussion whether one man can handle all the various functions that are required in a complex machine with interception and so forth, and it should be two men. But in those days, there was no question about it. The kind of equipment that was being provided, it hadn't crossed anyone's mind that a pilot might be able to handle all of those jobs. It was still very definitely a two-man job. So you had safety, which would it meant two engines, and it meant basically two people. And then finally, you had to have a missile that when you did launch it, you were damn sure that it wasn't going to miss, because you weren't going to get a second chance when you were operating out in that kind of the northern part of, or the northern periphery, certainly, of the built-up area or the ground environment, which, of course, was in at that time or going in. So the Canadian requirement was different to, say, NATO. And again, this is one of the problems, one of the reasons why NATO probably didn't go for it, aside from all the others, the political in-house problems that they had. In France and in Germany, where your warning time was literally a matter of seconds, you had to have an airplane that would literally stand on its tail and go straight up.
Yeah.
It had to, because otherwise the thing would be gone and passed. It would throw back to World War I when the fighters would take off but couldn't get up, climb fast enough to intercept the bombers, because they would have gone over, dropped their bombs, and been on their way back before the fighters could get up. Same basic problem. So the requirement there was for a light airplane, not too much range, good armament, of course. The armament was comparable, but it had to be able to get up, and it was under close control right from the moment of takeoff. It didn't have to operate independently in any way. Climb straight up, close control from radar, carry out its interception, shoot down whatever it was after, and get back down again. Rearm, go back up again, that sort of thing. Yeah, almost a yo-yo type of thing. Not so in Canada. It was a question of getting out and intercepting away forward, as far forward as you could get. And again, the reason for that was very simple, that these bombers were carrying nuclear weapons, and they knew they were going to be shot down, they would dump their load. Well, if there was any dumping of load, you wanted it dumped up in the northern part of Canada, nowhere near any built-up area. Mm-hmm. So there was that. And even in the United States at that time, even though NORAD was there, you still... No, NORAD, I guess, hadn't come into being, but there was lots of discussion through the Military Cooperation Committee on combining the efforts. In other words, in no border. Had it come into that date?
Yeah, Perkey agreed to it verbally.
That's right,
in
yes.
Formally
in
May of 58.
Yeah, okay.
We need every requirement at NORAD, then. Is that not correct?
No, because the United States requirement, again, was rather like the European one. At that time, their boundary was their airspace, not over Canada. And what they wanted to do was have something would take up and intercept anything which had gotten through Canada.
Yeah.
But Canadian airspace was a Canadian responsibility. Sure. And once it hit the U.S. border, then it became... Now, a little later, of course, airspace... The boundary aspect changed. But in those days, it was still a matter of sovereignty over the airspace over each other's country.
This aircraft, too, am I not correct in thinking that for its navigation and all the rest of it, you needed that, what the devil was it called, the ground control stations here, there, and the other thing.
Oh, yes, you still need... Yes, all... Oh, not for navigation?
Yeah.
No, the nav system... I can't remember what the nav system was in the darn aircraft. Although navigation was never too much of a problem, because the idea was it would be under radar control. See, our radar system was going to go quite up... Well, we had the mid-Canada line going in, and then south of that. That bird... When I talk about long range, of course, I'm not talking about getting up into the Arctic Circle or anything like that. I'm just talking about getting beyond the built-up areas and into what was the Pine Tree Line. The Pine Tree Line was designed and located where fighters could get beyond our industrial and built-up areas with enough time to carry out an interception before those bombers reached what you could call the last line, where if they dump weapons, people are going to be killed. And thus, it was a radar-controlled bird. But there were all kinds of beacons all over the place. So navigation was not a problem as such. Not with radar and beaconry. No, that was never a problem. Navigation only became a problem to an interceptor when he's done his job and he's trying to get back to base. Well, that's the only time. But hell, as long as his radios were working, what happened, of course, is as soon as he finished an intercept, the radar would give him a vector back to his base. All he had to do was fly that, then he got kind of sort himself out. Where the hell did I get to in this interception? And where am I? Sort of thing. In the meantime, he's heading in the right direction back to his base. And then the navigator would then pick up start to do navigation as opposed to an AI intercept.
Yeah.
So navigation was not as such a problem.
Well, let me ask you another question again before we get back to the money thing and where the crunchy decision had come in. Am I not right that at this time, when this decision is being made that this program just can't go on any further, that the former Air Vice Marshal Plant was with A.V. Rowe.
Right. He was.
Now, you would know him very
well.
Okay, right.
Well, there's a bit of background there, too. Johnny Plant had been the Air Member for Technical Services. As a matter of fact, he was the Air Member for Technical Services when I went to Imperial Defense College. At the end of 54 or the beginning of 55.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not too sure whether it was, I think it was while I was in England, or maybe it was just after I came back, that Johnny, speaking somewhere, made a comment in jest I think it was something to do with the Brown job, something like that. Well, it was one of those dreadful situations where the papers took off and ran with it, and they crucified Johnny Plant. The minister had to fire him, all because of literally what was taken out of context and built into a major issue, and Johnny Plant was fired. Well, the firing, by that time he'd gone out, I think he had gone out, he'd left AMTS, and he'd gone out and was the commander of our Air Materiel Command. And it was while he was commander out there that he'd made this comment. He hadn't been there very long, and he was fired. Well, of course, to a company like A.B. Rowe, he was an absolute present from heaven. Because here was a man who was totally in the picture on the government side, knew this requirement, had been with this program for a long, long time, knew it inside out. And knew all the people who were working on it, knew all the people in the Defense Production Department. What better man to suddenly grab hold of it? Here he is, he's up for grabs, and bring him in and make him a big wheel in the executive of the company that's trying to sell this program. And, of course, that's where he went. And he was an absolute gift for A.B. Rowe. So Johnny didn't suffer. But, well, I shouldn't say he didn't suffer, because he felt very badly. And so did everybody else. So there were a lot of people who almost resigned over that. When the minister, and I guess it must be, I don't know who the hell it was, the minister who got to the PM, but Johnny Plant was sacrificed. And this happened several times in the career. I know of 3 or 4 people who were sacrificed, literally fired, because of some comment they made speaking to the public.
Yeah.
And it was for that reason that the senior officers almost refused to speak to the public, because you never knew when something was going to be taken out of context, and you could be on that altar and sacrifice. And it's terrible. There was a group captain down at Summerside, base commander, just a group captain, made a remark. It was so partly critical of the government, and it wasn't a serious matter. It wasn't a matter of major policy. And the chief was forced to fire him. Literally, he was relieved. He was out of the service. All because the papers made such an issue of it in Ottawa. But here he is way down in Summerside, in PEI, speaking down there to us. In Summerside. Crazy. Anyway, it happened. Well, Johnny Plant, of course, I don't know, I've never talked to Johnny Plant about his feelings, but he would, gosh, if you want to know anything about the Arrow, my God, there's a man to talk to, because he, of course, was both on the inside in D&D, and then, of course, on the outside as an executive at AV Rope. And good to have both sides of the story. I'm trying to remember. I thought Johnny had spoken on this. Maybe he'd written something. I can't remember. But he'd certainly written it to have, because, boy, this is a long story. It's a sad story. To the Air Force, it was a dreadful story. I'd never known. I suppose the morale of the Air Force after when the decision was made to cancel was as low as it has ever been.
But
not because...
There was a period, nevertheless, Reg, as I remember it, presumably after the time when the